Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the best radio on the internet. Well, that's a statement I'm not making boastfully, but you know, because I believe it. I'm coming to believe it, mainly because lately I'm having trouble finding something I want to listen to when I want to listen to something. I've been listening to internet radio for a long time. Well, you know, quite a few, not a real long time, but 6 years maybe. And it's kind of grown on me, and there are things I try to learn from it, and there are a lot of shows that I liked. Of course, most I don't, but now, though, there's been a dearth of good programming, and I don't know if it's me or if it's the programming. Some shows are no longer going, but then I wasn't real hot on them anyway. So I'm going to be kind of critical tonight. excuse me. That's nothing new with me, but, I maybe, excuse me, that I think I have, learned most of what other hosts can teach me. And I keep, what I'm hearing is a repetition. I think hosts are not taking up new ideas as much as they should. I don't think that we should always just be looking for the latest idea, but I don't think we should just be staying in the same place and repeating ourselves either. There are foundational issues that don't change, but still we have to keep up and keep things, vibrant and interesting. Now, this reminds me of some listeners out there who posted some of my programs on YouTube. When I was looking up a question about Anthony Lawson last week, I came across my original interview with him put up by two different people. And it's kind of nice when you're searching for something and you see things of your own that you didn't even know were there. I want to thank those people who are doing that. And I also want to talk about donations tonight. Speaking of that, you might think about giving a donation to VOR, which always needs money because of the maintenance of the archives. But also, I want you to know that I've put a PayPal donation button on my personal website, CarolynYeager.com. And I've always said that I don't ask for money, and I'm not really asking for money, but the reason I've done this is because I see that so much money is being asked for and passed around. And, you know, there's always money. And money is going to people into things that I think maybe, in my opinion, are not the best use of the money. So I decided that I should, if people want to like what I'm doing and they want to send me money, I will use it to further the things that I believe in and the causes that I believe in. I made a point of saying that I don't intend to ever use any money that I receive in contributions for any personal needs of my own, because I don't need to do that. And that's why I never asked for money before. But now I see that, it kind of came from talking about this Einsatz group and book project, which I began speaking about, what, 3-4 weeks ago, and asked people to donate money, and I didn't start out very, very organized with it, but I did get some people sending me some money, and then I wrote, when I got it better organized, I wrote to some people who I knew were not poor and were supportive of of revisionism and Holocaust revisionism and would be interested in this, and sent them Carlo's email address and urged them to send money through PayPal or some other means if they wanted to just write to him and find out. And then I sent my donation, and it was received. I did mine through PayPal. I have a friend in Canada who was decided to send $500, and that's a good amount that you know helps to build it, you know, bring it to the full amount that they needed. This is for these three revisionists. I'll repeat their names in a moment, but he had trouble with PayPal, so he finally he was talking to me about it, and he finally managed to send it from his bank account to Carlo's bank account. He contacted Carlos. And so that money was sent. And today I got a few more emails from people who are sending some money. But yesterday I wrote to Jürgen Graf. This threesome who are going to be writing this book are Jürgen Graf, Thomas Kues, and Carlo Mantonio. And I wrote to Jürgen to find out how close they were to the goal. And I was told that they were only $350 away. No, 350 euros. That would be $500 away as of 2 days ago, from the $5,000 that they need for the beginning of this project to translate the microfilm into it, put it onto CD so they can read it. Now, this is amazing to me. I'm very proud of this, my part in this. And now that these other people have sent money, they may have now reached that goal. And that's okay if you keep sending money, because there will be more expenses involved in this. This is just the beginning of getting the microfilm, but it was absolutely necessary and maybe the biggest one to get it started. So I want to congratulate every one of you out there, and particularly the people who sent money. And I think someone else had gotten in touch with Carlo and talked about a good amount of support. So that maybe have come from somewhere else. But, you know, it's like when I talked to Jürgen, they didn't have any. Well, Jürgen had written in that article that he wrote saying that they wanted to do this project, but the money hadn't shown up yet. And so that kind of moved me. And when you have a purpose for money, and when you have a desire, and when you put it out there, it almost always will come. But I am surprised at how quickly this happened. And I think you should all be impressed by that too. And this should not be the end of the work that we do to try to direct money that we are going to be passing out here and there into the places where it will really do the most good. Now, I know everyone has their own idea of what will do the most good. And of course, I can't force my ideas on other people. I have mine, but I'm really pleased about this. I think that probably at this point, the goal has been reached, $5,000. That wasn't there a few weeks ago. So, that's the deal. That's what I wanted to say about money and donations. I have a few afterthoughts about 9/11, which I will say very quickly because it kind of leads into other things I'm going to talk about. And that is, during last week, I have classical music station on my car radio, and then sometimes their NPR news comes on. And I hear some of it. I really can't stand to listen to it anymore. This is public radio. I think it's just pure propaganda, given to us in a kind of a soothing voices that really goes into your consciousness much more than noisy kind of irritating radio does. Anyway, they were talking about all these remembrance ceremonies. And of course, after coming off of yesterday, we know all the things that they had going on. And, the new 9/11 memorial, in New York and other ones in other places. And then they talked about all kinds of services, you know, and musical events, special honor awards, and all these things which bring people together And I realized that this kind of a thing is absolutely necessary for governments to remain viable and to remain to keep the people's allegiance, because you know, it causes people to think that they are brought together for a reason and a purpose and with meaning, and that makes them feel like they're, you know, that they have a country, they have a nation that they belong to, and they all are feeling the same things, they're having the same experience. And this, of course, is necessary in dealing with any kind of an organization, a large, or, you know, a way of being successful with large groups. But it depends, I guess, on who's doing it, whether you, how much you like it. Well, I don't like this. And I see that they, you know, to keep people in some level of fear and dependence on the government for protection is what these people are all know that they have to do. And this is what something like 9/11 did. I mean, the carrying out of 9/11 did this. That is to create a big loss, to create a shock to the entire nation, to create something that the entire nation is supposed to experience together as one. And they have to have a lot of collateral damage in order to make it, you know, people notice it and make it powerful. There has to be collateral damage. There has to be deaths on a fairly large scale. And then you have the remembrance things that take place, and people feel like they must be respectful of all this because people died. Just like the 9/11 memorial. This is supposed to memorialize all the people who died, and you know, you can't make light of that. So they know this. They know how they manipulate people in this way. Therefore, you know, this kind of stuff makes me really sick. You know, I just get sick when I'm hearing about it, because I know, I realize sometimes without really realizing it, what it's doing. And of course, then they establish the historical narrative and get it in the history books, get it in the school curriculums, and get it into not just a national consciousness, but that's one part of it, but even into the global consciousness. I mean, it's just all manipulation, and they do it from start to finish. They create the event, and then they reap all the benefits from the event. So those were my thoughts on 9/11, not the kind of thoughts that most people were having, I admit. Now, I want to talk tonight about some radio programs. I started out talking about radio programs. And I might say that I have some gripes to broadcast myself here tonight. And what starts me on it is that I'm thinking about immigration, and I have come to the conclusion that immigration is the number one most dangerous development for us. Even though I understand the problem of Jewish power, and I have talked about it, and I'm on record about that, and I understand that Jewish power is tied up with the left and left thinking, and left thinking is what pushes immigration and causes us to be to think that racism is an evil thing. Anti-racism, anti-fascism is the big program of the left. And this is really, I think, the problem that we're in. And you find a lot of people who are supposed to be on our side. I'm told that, you know, I'm told when I criticize these people, well, you're criticizing people who are, we're all on the same side, and you, just because you have some differences with them, you should not be, you know, openly criticizing them or making a problem. But, you know, I had an experience a few weeks ago with Charles Giuliani on his Truth Hurts radio program. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that. I have to do that. I didn't have a chance to do it until now, but I have to do it now. So Charles is, I don't know too much. Well, I know all I want to know about Charles, but he probably talks about immigration some. But he mainly talks about conspiracy theories and his anti-Jew talk. I don't think he gets into immigration much. He has one of those messages that are pretty one-sided or strange. But anyway, he's on Oracle Broadcasting. And I always thought well of Charlie. Charlie has a nice way about him, and people think of him as a nice guy. And I was on his program sometime early in the year, I think, and talking about my Ellie Wiesel website and for 2 hours. He's got this 2-hour program in the morning, first thing in the morning, 8 to 10 central time, and that's my time. And he kind of holds forth there and says whatever he feels like. Once in a rare while, he has a guest, and he just goes on and on like I'm doing tonight. He asked me to be on his program when my RBN program was canceled. And so I said, all right. And I listened to one of his shows, and he had a caller who had said to him, and this was a regular kind of a caller friend, who said, they were talking about how the Jesuits were controlling the world, so to speak. He's very anti-Catholic now and anti-Christian, Giuliani, who says he used to be a former Bible student, a graduate of Bible college, and he was 100% for that. So he's kind of goes all out for things. But now he's gone the opposite direction. But this person who was on with him said, the Nazi party was Jewish. People don't know that, but it's true. So I heard that, and that's one of the things that I am kind of trying to correct in the thinking that is, there's so much thinking like that that's been put out all over about Nazis as Zionists and Nazis as Jews. So I was, I wrote to him, and I said, I mentioned that to him. I said I would like to spend my time on the program telling you and your listeners why that's not true. And he said, okay, fine. So I did that. But I got into it a little bit. I talked over, I guess, a couple of his callers towards the end who were really calling in to set me up because they were Hitler was a Zionist, guys. So I stood my ground, and when the show was over, everything was fine. But somehow Charlie that night, he thought it all over, or some of these people talked to him, and he decided that I had behaved badly. And on the next day, he got on his program, and for 40 minutes, he went on a rant against me. And he went so far as to use the B word against me several times. He even said F you twice, speaking about me. And I don't know if that was on Thursday morning or Friday morning, but because he started up again on Friday morning, he said, well, I'm just going to say a few comments. He didn't mean to go into all of that, but with Charlie, when he starts, he gets carried away. And pretty soon he's just frothing at the mouth and ranting and raving, and it's all being built up in his mind. And 10 or 15 or 20 minutes later, he comes to and says, gee, I've been going on too long about this. So then he even used the phrase, if she comes back on my show, she better behave herself better. And he said, I'll slap her back. Well, when I heard that, somebody wrote to me and told me that he had done this the following day. So I listened to it, and I was absolutely shocked. And so were several other people. I just thought, I can't just let this go. This kind of behavior, is, well, the word cur came to my mind. If you don't know what it means, look it up. But I wrote to, he's on Oracle Broadcasting. And I thought, what do these people think of having their radio host talking like this after he has a guest to talk about her like that when she's not there the next day and even the day after on his program? And so I wrote to them and described what had happened and said I thought that it was kind of atrocious. And, I got nothing from them. And he's still there. So there you are. There's Oracle Broadcasting for you. So I'm here to put in a bad word for Charles Giuliani and Oracle Broadcasting. Now, let me move on to, I've got a little bit of time here before the break. Let me move on to veterans today. I can't seem to get finished with this. You might think I'm ranting about them, but what the purpose that I have today is to do a little bit of congratulations, maybe, again, as I did about the Einsatzgruppen book, because, Veterans Today also does not mention immigration ever. Now, they're much more, that I know. They're not a radio program, of course. They're a website with lots of contributors. The only thing they ever go after is Israel and, of course, the U.S. government, but mostly the Republican aspects of it and not the Democrat aspects of it. And they're a liberal progressive stance, and they portray Israel and Zionism as bad, mostly because it's racist. And that's what they go after, racism. And this is what, you see, I want to focus on a little bit tonight, and that's why I'm coming at it from this angle. Now, I noticed that VT seemed to be losing people. I mean, they weren't there anymore, and they have a newer and less impressive list of contributors than what they used to have. I'm not sure who went first, but I know that Jeffrey Blankfort got disgusted with Duff over his constant mistakes and lies and thought that he was doing disinfo, particularly about 9/11. And I did a program about that. I've also had J. Bruce Campbell on as a guest a couple of times, and he does not want to say anything against Gordon Duff, but he has quit posting there, and he has said that he won't post there again. And he says that the only reason is because he doesn't think it's the right place for his particular kind of writings, that he's going to get a little bit stronger, although I haven't seen his new website yet. It's not up. But anyway, he's not there. He doesn't intend it. Now, there's a fellow, Jonathan Azaziah, who has resigned from writing at Veterans Today. He was featured there quite a bit. But he's done this in protest about Libya. And he was on a radio program the other day I listened to. That was one I did enjoy. He called Duff's position ridiculous, asinine, and, quote, supporting the Zionist narrative, unquote. Now, I've also found out that Franklin Lamb, who I never really paid any attention to, but he's gone. He was getting insults from VT's editors, I'm told. Actually, I read it. Other people said so. And certainly, Kevin Barrett has admitted that. And also, Anthony Lawson said that. He doesn't want to post there anymore. Now that was followed. He was followed up by Anthony Lawson, who actually refused to allow Duff to post his latest 9/11 10th anniversary video at VT. And Duff had put it up and had to take it down. And then he started writing nasty emails and making nasty comments about Anthony Lawson, on the site. And sending personal emails to Anthony that were quite unkind. So this shows the kind of person Duff can be. In the background, he really trashes people. But now the big one, Alan Sabrowski, left some time back, and he had to insist three times. He wrote to Duff three times insisting that they remove his name as a VT managing editor. He didn't want to be any part of it anymore. So you're not going to see any of these former contributors back there again. And there's another Muslim name, Arab name, that of somebody who is very turned off and has left, but I somehow didn't get it on my list here. Now, who's left? Who's left there? Alan Hart. Okay, I'm just about up to my break time here. Alan Hart, who is famous in, to me, I've criticized Alan Hart for being pro-Jewish and anti-Zionist. You know, he's an anti-Zionist, but he's always trying to protect Jews. He's still there with Gordon, because he thinks along the same lines. And also, now Gordon has come up with Jim Fetzer, and the someone who is there, who I don't know why she's there, is Ingrid Grimlin Zundel. And I think her reputation has been impeccable up till now, but now I'm wondering for how long, as she...
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Well, to talk more about the legacy of the 9/11 terror attacks, I'm now joined live from London by author and journalist Afshin Ratansi. Thanks so much for being with us live here on RT, Afshin. Well, the US saw the 9/11 attacks as an act of war on its own soil, so surely it was justified to lash out in the way that it did. I mean, what else would any other country have done in the same circumstances?
Well, it was certainly a tragedy, but the definition of an act of war, of course, is a nation state. It involves a nation state. And this wasn't Pearl Harbor, although, of course, Roosevelt at that time, they say, did know that was going to happen. This wasn't an act of war. It was a criminal act led by someone who was from a family who were very close to the Bush family. And I think many people now see it as a blowback for years and decades and arguably centuries of American power. And I suppose it signals the beginning of the end of American empire.
Why was the U.S. so completely unable to prevent this from happening, do you think?
I think institutional structures, even in a country as advanced as the sole superpower on Earth, were at fault. Many people have said the institutional and bureaucratic procedures didn't allow them to shoot down those planes before they hit the World Trade Center and so forth. But perhaps a bigger malaise here is that all systems seem to have failed. The media, the courts, the police forces, the intelligence agencies, government. It's as if, and this happens when empires start to fold. These structures calcify and arguably they can't stop asymmetric attacks anyway. I mean, it is difficult to attack, to defend yourself against a terror group like, which is small, and all it takes, as they say, is one of them theirs to be successful, and that's what happens.
Let's talk about the aftermath, the reaction, obviously, leading to the Iraq conflict and indeed the Afghanistan war. Well, it may have been a long 10-year war there in Afghanistan and cost more lives than the U.S. would ever have imagined, but surely, with Afghanistan now on a path to democracy, many would say this is the right thing to have happened. In other words, the conflict there in Afghanistan has been justified, hasn't it?
I think American intervention in Afghanistan and, of course, the other superpower previously, the Soviet Union, has proved again and again very dangerous for the superpowers involved. And we know that in the past few hours, I think it's 77 at the moment, the injured count of American soldiers in the past few hours. Afghanistan is not an easy place for America to take over. And I think if one asked Hamid Karzai, he'd say his first responsibility is to the Afghanistan people. He'd say that in public. And then to the wider region, not to the United States.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. As I was talking about, I had kind of left out speaking about the new format here at the Heretics Hour, which is now the Heretics 2 hours, and we will be running for 2 hours tonight, beginning at the top of the hour. I'll be taking phone calls for any of you who would like to call in and comment on any of the things I've been talking about, or actually on anything, because this is a free night, no guests, so there's not that prescribed about what we talk about. I'm really walking on thin ice here. I know I'm trying to be truthful and say things that I think should be said, but at the same time, and use my program in a way that I can speak out, you know, what I think. I can speak out for myself, so to speak. But at the same time, be considerate. And as I was talking about Ingrid Rimland-Zundel and her relationship with Gordon Duff there on Veterans Today. Now, if you get her power letter, you know that she's really quite happy with being there, because she believes that she's getting a very large readership for her articles, which could very well be true and probably is true, and that she's putting out good information, revisionist information, and that's true. But it's lately she's had some things that are kind of questionable, and I'm not the only one that is questioning where she's going with this. And she has written about the Nazis' UFOs as though they had a UFO program, and maybe Hitler and maybe a bunch of them are took off in UFOs and went to the other side of the moon or something, and they're still there, or they're somewhere. Not them, maybe, but there's still these German colonies on high mountains, or who have UFO technology. This was a little far out, and I didn't go for it. But now she's written a column about the moon Nazis. There's a movie coming out called The Iron Sky, and it's about Nazis going to the moon in their special aircraft and their great discoveries that they had supposedly made after the war. And there's a colony, and it's just a crazy, it's one of these crazy sci-fi movies making Germans look ridiculous, like Nazis, and children are there, you know, acting like little Heil Hitler kids and so on. And she seems to think it's a lot of fun, and she interviewed the producer of the movie, the director, and I made a comment about it that she didn't like, and said I was trying to pick a fight, and it was not becoming, because she's very busy with important work. Well, she may have some she may be going somewhere with this, I don't know. But, we all have important work to do, and I think we should answer questions if they're asked of us. That's all. And I think I just wonder, since I believe that it's very clear that Gordon Duff is a disinformation agent, and more people are coming to that conclusion and are even saying so and even using the word. And that he associates and makes his best friends, or the only friends that stick with them, are other disinformation agents, that it's an odd place for her to be. And it may be probably that she just is naive and has her own reasons. But that's the deal with Veterans Today. I think that even though it's like a, I think it's going to be a flash in the pan. I think that though it It made a big, came on big and strong. It has lost a lot of ground, and I think it will probably continue. Now that brings me, and I'm talking about the theme of these people, which is always, they avoid, that they're always anti-racist. Anti-racist. Another is Andrew Winkler, who runs Rebel News, used to run this Zio-pedia or Zio something way back when. excuse me. And I had a little run-in with him recently. But what bothers me about him and his site is that he comes out so strongly against racism, has no problem, never talks about immigration, but he says he's so anti-Jewish. At the same time, he has a real big conspiratorial view. You know, he's a big fan of Eustace Mullins, and he also likes to post stuff that connects Nazism with Zionism. So that's another thing that Veterans Today does. They put together, and Charles Giuliani does it. They're all doing it. They want to say the Nazis were the Zionists. This kind of thing, I've talked about this before. I'm not going to go into it now. But this to me, this is bothering me. I can't keep quiet about it. And I'm going to go into this a little bit more after I look through some of the comments on Veterans Today that I was going to bring up. I don't think I need to bring up these, but I will bring up this weird thing that that Gordon Duff said. I feel safe picking on him. There was under this the Zundel article, "The German Reich Exists," has been very popular. I made some comments about that. It's good. It's somebody else who wrote it, and she posted mostly what they wrote. But this is an important idea, and they were talking about the atom bomb. Some in the comments talking about that somebody said, "Well, the Jews came to the United States and made the atom bomb. They were the," and someone was saying that. The Jews built the bomb. And then another fellow said that was talking about the Manhattan Project and scientists who invented the atomic bomb in Manhattan. They're all Jews and so on. And then Gordon Duff comes. Every once in a while, he'll come up with a comment. You know, he comes up. He says short ones. He says Germany was building an A-bomb in World War I at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute under Einstein. Big secret, he says. I thought, what is that? And no one replied to that. It didn't go, you know, there was not, that was it. It was just left there. But, you know, Einstein moved to Germany in 1913. He had lived outside of Germany with his family. And he moved there in 1913 to teach in the University of Berlin. And what German nuclear energy project there began in April 1939 after the discovery of nuclear fission in January 1939. Now, the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute was founded in 1917 by the government as a collection point for funds to support the work in the field of physics. It didn't amount to much. It was based in the private apartment of his director, Albert Einstein, in Schoenberg. So that's how it got to be that he says, you know, this was under Einstein. Einstein was the director of it in the beginning, but it wasn't doing it. It was just supporting the work in physics. And of course, Einstein had come up with his relativity theory. But they weren't building a bomb. And it was not until 1937 that this Kaiser Wilhelm Institute was given a large building. And it was partly financed, according to Wikipedia, by the Rockefeller Foundation. And then this new research center 1937 became the Max Planck Institute. So what we have here with Gordon Duff coming up with his stuff is just so crazy. When he says big secret, he'll say, well, this is a secret and he got this from his sources. Absolutely doesn't make any sense. It's not true that Germans were not building an A-bomb in World War One. Nobody was building an A-bomb in World War One. But, you know, he'll say something like that. I don't think he was joking. I think he puts stuff in there to try to act like he's got some knowledge. I'm going to just leave it at that. Okay. And I'm going to go into, the other thing is, recently Gordon Duff, along with Jim Fetzer and Kevin Barrett, were written up by the ADL as being, anti-Semites because they're saying that Israel was behind 9/11. And you know, Gordon Duff got into 9/11 like last year. Or the year before. Before that, he was a believer in the official story. He was, everything is new to Gordon Duff. But I still don't think that he's an honest man. But what we have is that he's using this write-up by the ADL like a big badge of honor. He's bragging about it. And he's even written to Anthony Lawson saying that the ADL didn't write him up. The ADL doesn't have a problem with him, which means that he's, he must be a friend of theirs. You know, nonsense like this. I really think that it's very possible that he's working with the ADL and wants the ADL, wants it to be seen that the ADL is really worried about Duff and Fetzer and so on. Fetzer's been, writing this stuff all along and he never got mentioned by the ADL before. So, but now that he's associated with Duff, they're all written up together, the threesome. So it's kind of fishy. I don't believe any of it. I don't think, I think he might be, they might be working with the ADL and, they have to make it look like they're the enemy. You know, they're the real danger to the Jews, which they're not. Now, what is the danger to the Jews? It's people waking up to racialism. That's why they all push anti-racism. That's why racism is made out to be the worst crime that anybody can commit. I am against Jewish power, and I do see it as a major threat to decent and livable life on this earth. You know, I'm clearly on record on that, but I have been saying lately because it has come home to me that immigration is the most powerful tool of the Jews against white society. And it's even more powerful right now than the control of money because immigration is something that's moving like a huge tidal wave against us. And the other things, have been around for a long time and they're not going to swallow us up immediately. But immigration is. Intelligent people can figure out a way to get out from under debt finance, but and these other things that the Jews are doing. But unintelligent people can't, and they can't figure out anything else either. And that's really why they have determined on lowering our IQ via race mixing and making racial thinking a moral crime, so we can't oppose it. I am not against other races, and I am not going to go along with the idea of being afraid of talking about race because it's going to make me look like someone who hates everybody that isn't a member of the white race. I am a member of the white race, and I am 100% a 100% white person, and I like my own people, and I want my own people to continue, and I want my own culture to continue. There's nothing wrong with that, and many have said that. This is nothing new coming from me. This is being said on Voice of Reason Network all the time. But I think maybe we need to go up against those who attack more strongly, those who attack on the basis of you're being a racist, more strongly than simply saying, oh, they call you all these names. We know they call all these names, but maybe we need to talk back. We need to call names back, or maybe we need to fight back a little bit harder. I think so. And we need to be able to talk about IQ. Now, I know a lot of people talk about IQ. Well, not a lot, but, you know, people in the white movement talk about IQ. Because IQ, I would agree, is very, very important. And to have our IQ lowered, which is already being lowered, is very important. We can't ignore that. So anybody who goes along with denouncing talk about IQ and race, I will say, is working on the side of the Jews. Whether you can say, well, they don't know that. Well, maybe they better, somebody better tell them, you know, so that they do know it. And this means Andrew Winkler and all the folks at Veterans Today, they can say they're anti-Israel, they're anti-Zionist, but you see, they're also anti-racist. And they think that it's just fine if we just mix around. They're not going to mix, I don't suppose. But they want to make it so that a whole lot of people do. I'm going to talk about our demographics in a minute. But let's think about this. Let's look at it because it's so obvious. It's obvious because it's so effective. You know, it's effective and it's working, and we're not doing enough about it. You know, I think we have to get all liberal, left-wing, Marxist, humanist, egalitarian baloney out of our systems entirely in order not to be subject to these anti-white ideas. So many people are anti-white. You listen to Andrew Winkler, who's supposed to be working against the Jews or something, and you get him in a conversation with a couple of people who are like-minded with him, and they start trashing whites. I've got some emails that show it. They start trashing whites, something fierce. They're not on the side of whites. They're so upset with what they consider to be racism that they just can't hardly see straight. This is no good. We need to see through this. Let me talk about my part of the country. Okay, I live in the Mestizo Belt. These people that I call Mestizos, they're called Hispanics. The word Hispanic really bothers me because they're not Hispanics. Hispanic means Spanish. The people in the United States that are called Hispanic, for the great mass of them, are not Spanish. They're basically South American Indians mixed with varying degrees of Spanish blood. Sometimes very little, and some don't have any. Mestizo is a term traditionally used in Latin America and Spain for people of mixed European and Native American heritage or descent. The term originated as a racial category. During the colonial period, mestizos quickly became the majority group in much of what is today Latin America. And when the colonies started achieving independence from Spain, the mestizo group often became dominant. In some Latin American countries, such as Mexico, the concept of the mestizo became central in the formation of a new independent identity that was neither wholly Spanish nor wholly indigenous. And the word mestizo acquired its current double meaning of mixed cultural heritage and actual racial descent. Well, what are called Mexicans are mestizos. And none of these people, for the most part, except very few, are really Spanish or Hispanic. And they are very aggressively for their own race and culture. They're not European in any way, shape, or form, which Spanish people are. They're not white. They're not European. They have a totally very different culture. They are Catholic for the most part. That's the one thing that they share. And so this all might get into in a little bit. I don't have much time left. But consider what happened to these beautiful white children born to Norwegian women fathered by German forces, occupying forces during World War II. I'm going to jump to this because first we have where we have to consider so carefully all these children, these mestizo children, these Jewish children, yet these white children that were born to Norwegian women during the German occupation in Norway and during World War II, the SS established places for these children because they were mixed between German and Norwegian, and the Norwegians were against that idea. They wanted to protect these children. They wanted to make sure that they had a good chance in life because they saw them as racially valuable. There's that racial thing. Of course, as soon as we start talking about seeing people as racially valuable to us, the anti-racists get all up in arms, and most people are very uncomfortable. But, you know, if you are white, if you are German and Norwegian, then German and Norwegian people, children, should be racially valuable to you. But what has happened in Norway, and I think the Norwegians have gone crazy, of course, at that time, they totally treated all those children terribly and even tortured them and abused them very badly because they were part German. But also, what I really want to say is that to find your own, the children of your own race more valuable to you than the children of other races is natural. But now in Norway, the people have become so crazy that they are welcoming people of very, very different races into their country and giving them welfare and trying to bring in as many as possible, it seems, and allowing these people to rape their daughters and their wives and allowing a lot of things to be done. And yet they don't want to take care of their own racial offspring. They're all for this mixed business going on. Now, they're Lutherans. But instead of following Luther, they love the Jews. Luther came to dislike the Jews and wrote against the Jews, but Lutherans have suppressed that, and they don't want anybody to think that way. Instead, they hate their fellow white people, it seems. This is what religion often does. It, instead of building racial consciousness and racial love, it says, no, we should, it's wrong to love your own, and we must love others instead. There's something, you know, all this is so screwed up. And if we don't get it straightened out, and if we don't get some courage to fight off this anti-racism and be and stop being afraid of the whole idea of racism, we're not going to get anywhere. There is a map, demographic map from the 2010 census, which shows that the percentage of infants under age one who are now non-white in 2010 was 60% and above. 60%, no, in certain areas here of the country, it's 60% and above. And of course, I live in this 60% area, and it covers the Southwest pretty good, and then spotty all over. But the best that there is, the widest parts of the map, which is quite a lot of space of the United States, but still the best part is only less than 40%. So it's, you know, up to 40% are non-white. That's not good enough. It should be like, you know, if we really, in the widest parts of the country, it should be 90%. And I'm sure there are some parts of the country that are still 90%, but they're shrinking rapidly. And what we have is this tremendous change in our demographics of racial change. And there's no way that a person who's a real white person cannot care about this if they know about it. I think people are in denial. They prefer not to think about it because they're so afraid of being considered unkind they can't think that it's all right to think along racial lines. That's really what it is. Can we think along racial lines, or is that completely outlawed for all of us for all time from now on? Well, I'm going to continue the next hour. If I don't have callers, I have a lot more to say, but I do welcome.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
From FSN, I'm Kate Moody with the latest world news. European and Asian markets slipped amid renewed fears about the European debt crisis, although shares on Wall Street erased earlier losses in a dramatic late-session recovery. Reports suggested that Germany may be preparing for an orderly default by Greece, and French banks fell amid rumors of a possible downgrade of their debt and concerns about their exposure to Greece and Italy. Astronomers in Chile have discovered 50 previously unknown exoplanets. They include 16 super-Earths, planets with a greater mass than our own, but below those of gas giants like Jupiter. One of those super-Earths orbits inside the habitable zone, the region around a star where conditions could be hospitable to life. At least 75 people have died and more than 100 have been injured after a petrol pipeline explosion and fire in Kenya's capital, Nairobi. The blast took place in the city's Lunga Lunga industrial area and may have been sparked by a cigarette butt being thrown into an open sewer that was filling with fuel. The pipeline runs through the densely populated Sinai slum area between Nairobi's city center and the airport. The United Nations says the death toll in Syria has topped 2,600 since anti-government protests began in March. President Bashar al-Assad's troops continued their crackdown on demonstrators, conducting raids around the central city of Hama. His regime got a boost from Russia, which said it would not support a UN resolution condemning the violence if it included sanctions. UN Human Rights Chief Navi Pillay called on Syrian authorities to protect civilians.
Justice cannot be meted out summarily. Rather, it must be delivered, whether through national judicial mechanisms or international mechanisms, in accordance with human rights principles and the rule of law.
U.S. President Barack Obama has again urged Congress to pass his $447 billion package of tax cuts and new spending aimed at creating jobs.
This is a bill that will put people back to work all across the country. This is the bill that will help our economy in a moment of national crisis.
The plan, which he unveiled last week, includes money for improving infrastructure, modernizing schools, and state aid for teachers and emergency workers, as well as a payroll tax break. Leading Republicans like House Speaker John Boehner have indicated they may support pieces of the plan, but not as a sweeping piece of legislation. And President Obama said his proposals have garnered bipartisan support in the past.
The bottom line is, when it comes to strengthening the economy and balancing our books, we've got to decide what our priorities are. Do we keep tax loopholes for oil companies, or do we put teachers back to work? Should we keep tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires, or should we invest in education and technology and infrastructure, all the things that are going to help us out-innovate and out-educate and out-build other countries in the future?
There's more on these and other stories from our reporters around the world, including video, audio, and analysis on our blog, fsnreportersblog.com. This is FSN.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. We're now in the second hour of the two-hour Heretics Hour, and now we have open phone lines, and well, there is a caller, I believe. Hi, caller. What's your name, and where are you calling from?
Hi, my name is Leslie, and I'm calling from Seattle.
Okay. Hi, Leslie, did you say?
Yeah, L-E-S-L-I-E, Leslie.
Okay, well, what do you have to say? Welcome.
But sometimes people get confused with the name because it can be a girl's name, but it's also a popular boy's name, at least, you know, from the part of the country
yes.
that I came from. So.
Yes, it is. You're right.
You were talking about these people are always trying to confuse, somehow they try to confuse Israel with Nazism and that sort of thing, and Judaism with Nazism as being sort of synonymous. I was listening to a show this weekend. I forget if it was Saturday or it was Sunday, yesterday, I believe. And you could tell that the guest was strongly trying to suggest, you know, it was a 9/11 show. Yeah, it was Sunday, discussing the 10th anniversary of 9/11 attacks. And you could tell that the guest really had a fairly strong opinion that Israel was behind the 9/11 attacks. But the host of the show is a Jewish woman. And, you know, she kept talking about George Bush and basically anyone who's a Republican and not a Jew. That's what was sort of her whole way of approaching it. And
well,
this guy was sort of...
Who was the host? Could you tell us? You said she's a Jew. I don't know of a female Jewish radio host. Well,
yes,
I do.
Her name is Dumarie.
Oh, okay. Not Amy Goodman. All right. Dumarie. I don't know that person. All right. Thanks.
Yeah,
continue.
Her first name, I'm thinking I'm trying to think of her first name. Is it Joyce or... she's on the RBN network Sunday mornings from 8 till 10.
Oh, okay.
And
I don't listen
you
to
go
those.
To the,
yeah.
Oh, well, you're lucky. It's a lousy show, but, you know, what else are you going to listen to? You have a choice on Sunday morning of listening to that, or you can imagine pretty much what else is on the radio on Sunday mornings.
Well, I know. That's what I was trying to get across early in the first hour of this program, that, you know, I'm kind of in the habit of when I'm doing certain things around the house or things, I like to have a radio program on. I guess I should turn to music and start listening to music. But I used to think I was always learning something, you know, and I've been having trouble coming up with anything to listen to. But anyway, you tell us about this show you were listening.
In fact, you could go to the archives in that, you know, because I did call in. I called in, was very near the end of the second hour. So, and you can hear the conversation. The guest that she had on, I could tell from listening to him that he was very strongly, you know, trying to get across the idea that Israel was very highly likely involved in the 9/11 attacks, you know, and then and also he was mentioning sort of the neocon element in the administration, but the host kept trying to direct everything, you know, at she would name George Bush, she would name basically anyone who was a Gentile and who was a Republican. And, you know, she was claiming that the whole Bush...
that's what they do.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so I called in and I tried to point out, you know, she kept saying, well, you can't blame this on any one group. You can't blame it on Jews. You can't. It's all about, you know, it's Christians, it's evangelists, she went a whole bunch of basically red herrings, basically. You're trying to sort of direct the conversation away from where this guest obviously wanted to go. And so I phoned in and I said, you know, I really don't think you're understanding what this guest is trying to say here. You know, Project for New American Century, all the neocons in the White House, the vast majority of them are Jews. And she was like, oh, no. And then she basically, they went to a break. And during the break, she went so far as to tell me that Bill Kristol is a Nazi.
Well, she's obviously one of these nuts, you know, Bill Kristol. These people, I find that hard to believe, but yet I know they do talk like this. These people have got it. They have decided to make everybody who is working for Israel to be a Nazi. That this is the game that they play. And I don't know if someone like this woman, who's hosting this show, really believes this. Or if she's a disinformation agent. I think there's a tremendous amount of disinformation, but I can't believe that all of these people are agents. So I think some of them just fall for this, and they find themselves on RBN.
Well, she told me that the entire Bush administration was Gentiles. She did this during the break. It was just a lecture on her part. I didn't get, you know, she didn't allow me to put in a word edgewise. And then the final thing that she said is, Bill Kristol is a Nazi. And I said, man, please. You know, and then they went back to the show. But then the guest came on, you know, I don't know. It was just strange. And he told me, he said, you can't. What I said was, you know, all these people that you're talking about, sir, are Jews. I think you're, and I said, you know, I think your host, she's Jewish, but she's going to have to wake up and smell the gefilte fish.
Yeah. Okay. So well, anyway. So what's the larger point here? Because you know we've.
The larger point is.
Yeah. Go ahead.
The larger point is that I've been having the same problem that you are because, but you know, then I tried to listen to NPR and it's like I listen to all of the people. All of the hosts on that show are Jewish, and when they bring guest experts on, they're always Jewish. I was listening to it a couple of days ago. I said I cannot continue to listen to this alternative media because it's become so stupid, as you were saying earlier. But then I turned on NPR, and it was a conversation about how we must do more about global warming, and the one guest was a Jewish guy with the I can't think of the name of that Zionist organization. I can't think of it. And then the woman was some Jewish college professor. And the host was Jewish, and it's worse listening to the alternative media.
Yeah,
so it's a tough choice.
Now, NPR is Jewish. You know, it really is. It's just almost anyone you can think of there. If you look into it, you find out that they're Jewish. And they started out being taken over by saying that they needed to have more Jews on NPR. And they got this woman, this Jewish woman, to be the head person, to run the whole thing. And now it's just about all Jewish. And all they talk about are issues that the Jews want to talk about. So my answer to this, and also to alternative radio, which is becoming quite bad, is to determine some basic truths and some basic guidelines, and then when you see people not following that or going against that, say such as white racial issues and immigration, if they don't, then if they say, oh, they're supposed to be on our side, they're talking about truth issues and so on, but they stay away from all of that and they're pushing these things like anti-racism and and anti-fascism and so on, which they misdefine fascism, then you know that they're wrong and that they're not anybody to listen to. And we need to understand more and more that what you seem to do, that alternative media is filled with this stuff.
But, you know, when you think about National Public Radio, I mean, people should be outraged. I mean, you think of the millions of dollars in public funding that they get, and they just turned it into another Jewish think tank. I don't know what you do. But, I mean, like me, I hate silence. I've got to have something on all the time. And so, yeah, I guess you have to take the bad with the good. Okay, well, dear.
All right.
Oh, I thought of the name of that show is Capital Forum. It's on Sunday mornings, 8 to 10. It's called Capital Forum. Do you want to listen to the archives for the last 20 minutes? It got pretty heated because it was kind of awkward because you could tell that the guest wanted to say what he wanted to say, but and then he warned me. He said, you can't say the word Jew. You know, he said he's got the ADL after him. And I better be careful. You know, you might want to go to his website. He was pretty interesting,
right.
I thought. You know. Okay, thank you, dear.
Okay, thank you, Leslie.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, ladies and gentlemen, the call-in number is 1-855-477-2283. I'd like to mention some things more about the Lebensborn program because it's been so badly trashed, and so many people think that have the total wrong idea about what the German Lebensborn program was all about. And what I have in my notes here for tonight is that these white children were born to Norwegian women fathered by German occupying forces during World War II. Of course, the Norwegians, even though the Germans did not treat them badly, and even though it was the British that were bombing them and destroying parts of their country in order to fight the Germans who were there, they continued to be on the side of the British. I do not know why, because they're far closer to, well, I don't know if they are or not. They're all related. English, German, Norwegian, to some degree, all related peoples. But I know the Germans and the Third Reich thought of the Norwegians and the Swedes as a Germanic people, part of the kind of Germanic people. But the Norwegians didn't go along with that. And so they hated the Germans, and they continued to hate them, even though they weren't treated badly by the Germans. So in Norway, during this period of time, a local Lebensborn office was established in 1941, because, of course, it was in 1940 that the Germans had their great victories in the West. And the task of it was to support children of German soldiers and their Norwegian mothers pursuant to German law, because this was Hitler's law of July 28, 1942. Now, the organization ran several homes where pregnant women could give birth. The facilities also served as permanent homes for eligible women until the end of the war. Additionally, the organization paid child support on behalf of the father because, of course, these fathers were serving in the war. Some of them may have been killed, and some were simply just still being soldiers, and they could not do that. And it covered other expenses, including medical bills, dental treatment, and transportation. You know, these were love relationships, it's mostly considered. These Norwegian women fell in love with these German soldiers, and I'm sure the German soldiers, I don't love them too. Sometimes women fall in love more than men do, and, you know, love is more serious to women. But you know, they were not, certainly were not raped or anything. There's nothing like that that involved in this. So there were between 9 and 15 Lebensborn homes established in Norway. And it's estimated that 10 to 12,000 children were born that had German fathers during the war, and 8,000 of them were registered by the Lebensborn organization. And in 4,000 of these cases, 4,000 of these 8,000, the father is known. And I guess the other half, the father was not known. There was no name. But these children, as I said, were not from rapes. They were from regular love relationships. And during and after the war, though, the Norwegians commonly referred to these children as German kids or Kraut kids, which was in Norwegian a derogatory term. Later, after their mistreatment post-war was recognized, a more diplomatic term, war children, came into use, and now that's generally what these war children are called. Now, of course, they grew up, and but some of the things that happened were pretty terrible. When the war ended, the children and their mothers were viewed as outcasts by many among the general populace, who felt antagonized by the war and everything that had to do with Germany. The children and their mothers experienced isolation, and many children were bullied by other children and sometimes by adults due to their origin. The German fathers were never permitted to visit them in Norway. Of course, the soldiers, the German soldiers were not honored in any way, even in Germany after the war. They were just considered people who got involved, unfortunately, in something that the Germans were ashamed of. So, this is under German re-education by the Allies. So it says that the German fathers who may have tried to send payments and letters to their children and to these women, these payments and letters were often withheld, confiscated. They were stolen and misappropriated by mayors, by officials, Lutheran pastors, and other people in authority. This was a general hatred of Germans after the war and for quite a long time afterwards. Now, immediately after the war ended, 14,000 of these Norwegian women were arrested. 5,000 were, without any judiciary process, placed in forced labor camps for a year and a half. Their heads were shaved. They were beaten and raped. In an interview for the Swedish newspaper, someone who was interviewed claimed that war children in an orphanage in Bergen, this would have been in, where is Bergen? Is that Sweden? The little children were forced to parade on the streets so the local population could whip them and spit at them. This is supposedly true. That's why I say the Norwegians are crazy. They're Lutherans, I understand, but instead of following Luther, they want to love the Jews and hate their fellow white people. They try to bring as many non-whites to their country, as I already said, and give them welfare and so on. Now, going back to these war children, they founded a group and took their country of Norway to court twice. One report on the 19th of July, 2007, says that a group of 154 Norwegian war children with German fathers, along with four Swedish and one German national, have turned to the Strasbourg Court, which is a European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, France, one of these European things that were set up after the war for human rights of all people, and they demanded financial compensation and recognition of their suffering from the Norwegian government. But the result is that their complaint, was thrown out of court. Their lawsuit was thrown out of court. Something that would have never happened if the case were for a Jewish group of children. But we're left with the conclusion that these Norwegian German children are considered of lesser value. Norwegian German children are considered of lesser value than non-white children of various types and races and nationalities. And this is what it's come to because of this crazy hatred of what's considered Nazism, which is somehow was based on some racial thinking, which has been turned into being, you know, just violently, vehemently racist in the worst possible way. It's been, of course, distorted into something that it never was. It was racial thinking for a nation, national, racial, all going together, which is only reflective of real life. That's how things are. But what the left brings to us, which is what is so vile about it and so harmful about it, is that it brings ideas that are unnatural. It is not natural to have this. This is really, it's Marxist type thinking. It's unnatural to say that we are all equal. It's unnatural to say that it shouldn't matter to you if you're with a white person or a black person or a brown or yellow person, and of the various cultures. It's not just color either. You know, they try to make out that it's just the color that a person is. If you're brown, you're just the same person, only one has a brown coloring and one has a white or a pinkish coloring or whatever. You know, this is nonsense. Because intelligent people are those people who are up on racist writings, racial writings along, and IQ and so on, and all of these studies know better. And culture, the cultural differences. Anybody who just looks at life around us, we all know better. But we're taught not to see what we see with our own eyes, but we're taught to believe what we're being told. This is the dictum of the left. And everything is made into a moral issue. So you can have someone like Andrew Winkler, who runs Rebel News, who supposedly is all for, having debate on the Holocaust and let's get the truth out, you know, and he's so against Jews. And especially Israel and so on. But he will go bananas, if you want to talk, well, I've already said this, but if you want to talk about the obvious things about race, he won't go there. And he finds that revolting. He finds that, that turns him off. He finds that repulsive. And he brings up his Christian beliefs and so on. Where is someone like that coming from? I don't know. Maybe he believes it. You know, I can't say that people don't believe what they're saying, that they're all just working for something that's harmful to the white race. Not necessarily. But can't they see through it? We need to teach our people. We need to quit playing around with this. A lot of people go along with this because they don't want to offend others. They want to get their articles published, and they want to get people to come to their website. They want to get guest spots on radio programs. They want all this, and if they can get this, they will go along with just about anything, because that's what comes first with them. Well, I will go on to, instead of ranting about this, I think I made my point. I will go on to Austrian Gerd Honsek, who was released from prison this past week, last week, early on parole. And we're almost coming up to the next break. But this is really an interesting story. What a great guy this Gerd Honsek is, an Austrian. And these Austrians are crazy too. They're as nutty as the Norwegians. They just like the Norwegians. They've been made that way. Their governments and the pressure of the political power structure has forced these people into these crazy beliefs and actions that they carry out, which are totally against their own self-interest, and they don't know how to stand up for their own self-interest. All right, here's our break. And when I come back, I will talk about a few more things that I hope will be of interest to you. Be right back. This is Carolyn Yeager.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
We're seeing these protests on the streets of Greece again this weekend. Police officers, firefighters, students, taxi drivers, the list goes on. Have the Greeks had enough of being told what to do? What's the feeling there?
Well, if I was Greek, I certainly would feel like I've had enough to do with the whole charade that's been going on. You know, these austerity cuts are really, really much, much deeper than people realize. These are cuts that are reaching into people's homes and lives. And people, when faced with the uncertainty of where they're going to get their next meal or where they're going to get a job, when jobs don't exist and a future that's just plain bleak, and they see an outside group of people who have no cultural identity in line with themselves calling the shots as to how they're going to live their futures and the policies they're going to live underneath of, they oftentimes turn to violence. And this is not something that's new in history. So faced with survival, people turn to the violent side of nature sometimes to deal with situations.
But the brave talk's going on from the Prime Minister, at least. He's promised, as I mentioned, they'd fight until the bitter end and avoid it a fault. Do you think he's giving in to pressure again from the EU to keep that precious Euro flag flying?
Well, giving in to pressure from the EU, I think that he comes from a fairly long line of political aristocracy, and it would be fair to say, in my opinion anyway, that he is he's been pandering to the EU elites for some time. I think the politicians, it's kind of like the central bankers who people turn to try to solve the very problems they've created. These guys are the ones who are responsible at the end of the day. Him, his predecessors, all the people who decided that it was in the best interests of the people of Greece, because this isn't about Greece, it's about people. And the people of Greece are not going to be any better off under the austerity measures being levied against them today. I would argue it has more to do with a consolidation that puts more power in the hands of the Eurocrats and takes away even more of the national identity that belongs to whatever's left of Greece, as we refer to it.
Anthony, we keep banging on about this on this station because it's such an obvious question. I mean, despite the billions of euros worth of bailouts we've seen so far, the Greek economy doesn't seem to be benefiting still. I mean, should Greece leave the eurozone to avoid sinking even deeper? Isn't this just prolonging the agony?
Well, here again, whether Greece decides to leave, I think it comes down to the people. And when the people are frustrated enough and the people are no longer willing to take the outside shots being called by others, and when the people realize that they're no better off and the austerity will not work. Look, no one's going to sit here and suggest, certainly not me, that Greece has been fiscally responsible, that they've been following what I would consider responsible monetary policy. They certainly haven't. But nonetheless, it's up to the Greek people themselves to determine what austerity measures will be implemented. They certainly don't want to be taking orders, I wouldn't think, from people.
return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm still talking here. And I invite you to call me if you are there. If there's anybody out there listening, call me at 1-855-477-2283 to discuss anything you want to discuss. And if not, if I have no callers for this last half hour, I can continue talking about some things that I think are of interest. And I'm going to move into the revisionist area now. This Austrian, Gerd Hanzig, was released from prison. What a story this man has, and what a fine man he is. You know, these are my people. He's considered a far-right author who has questioned the Holocaust, and he has now served 3 years in prison, and he was supposed to serve, I think, five, or at least four, and he's been paroled early. Because they say basically, they don't say why, but they assume it's because he's old. He's 68 years old. But I think the real reason is that, yes, he's 68 years old. Plus, he never did anything wrong. And they can hardly keep this man in prison for no good reason. And, you know, I found out that he had been in prison in the 1960s from the EJP, which is a Jewish press. They had an article on this. They said that Hanzig served 4 years in prison in the 1960s. And he was sentenced again to 1.5 years in 1992. That's when he went to Spain rather than go back to prison. As all he had done was publish a book called Acquittal for Hitler with a question mark after it. Okay? It was a book questioning, should there be an acquittal for Hitler? Well, this is what I talk about a lot, that Hitler needs to be reevaluated. We need to talk about Hitler in real terms and, you know, and not in this crazy nonsense that so many of these people in the alternative so-called media are still doing, still playing that game. For what reason, I don't know. I don't know why they think they're just afraid to go there. But this is what we need to do. And this brave man was saying that in the 1960s. Of course, you know, the 1960s was very close still to the end of World War II. You know, it wasn't until the 1950 that things kind of got normalized to some degree in Europe. And then through the up to 55 or so, they were still dealing with an awful lot of this stuff. And, you know, in 1960, we were already in a kind of a new age beginning, very left-wing age. But there in Germany, Austria, among all those people, they still hadn't been affected by the re-education and hadn't changed their minds too much. And they were trying to still speak out some truth that they thought needed to be said. But, you know, they went to prison for that then. I mean, he went to prison in 1960s for just publishing this book. And anyway, he stayed in Spain for 15 years, but he continued to publish. And they finally, I don't know, managed to extradite him back to Austria in 2007. I think that they knew where he was, but they hadn't managed to get the Spanish government, I think, to cooperate. But finally, the Spanish government did, and he was extradited back to Austria in 2007, and he was given a put on trial. What was he put on trial for? Okay, let's look here. For writing books and for writing in right-wing publications that praised the Hitler era and contained anti-Jewish sentiments. So, as you know, Austria is very bad, has very bad laws like this because, you know, they were forced, being that they were part of the Third Reich and wanted to be, that afterwards they were almost as guilty as the Germans, although they didn't want to make them as guilty They tried to pretend that the Austrians were forced into joining the Reich, which wasn't at all true. They very much wanted to, but then the Austrians went along with that, a lot of them afterwards, because it made things easier on them. And I guess you can't blame people who have suffered and are suffering tremendous deprivation to want to save their people by not continuing to be targeted so badly. So if they're able to get out from under it to some degree by, denying the truth that they know, they will do it, and they will think, well, we have to do this now because these are the powers that are here, and there's nothing we can do about it. And they're right about that. And why continue to starve if you can have more food? You know, the Austrians did not, they had a bad food situation for 5-10 years after the war, especially the first 5 years, but not as bad as the Germans had it. So because they went along, they got the leadership to go along by saying, oh, yes, we didn't really want to be a part of the Third Reich. We didn't really want to be under the Nazis at all. We wanted we didn't have any choice. They forced us. Okay, it looks like I have a caller on the line. I'm going to break right into myself here and find out who the caller is. Hi there.
Hello, this is Hadding in Florida. As near as I can gather, Gerd Honzik was charged with the same crime as David Irving, which is Wiederbetätigung, reactivation of the National Socialist Party.
Okay, well, do you think he was really trying to reactivate the National Socialist Party?
Probably not. It was certainly a stretch in Irving's case to say that.
Absolutely.
But, you know, that law, by the way, that's from 1947. That was apparently.
Oh, thank you.
By the way, do you know who is a famous instance of a Norwegian war child?
Gee, I suppose I should, but I know nothing comes to my mind.
She's a singer, famous singer, Frida Lyngstad from ABBA.
Okay.
She was born in northern Norway from a married German soldier father and a 19-year-old Norwegian girl. And it's the Wikipedia article about her says that she and her mother and grandmother fled Norway for Sweden in 1947 to escape persecution.
Wow. And so I bet most listeners, as myself, don't know about this woman and this singer. So can
Frida Lyngstad with ABBA. ABBA, very,
oh, okay.
You know, you've heard of ABBA.
Yes, I've heard of ABBA. You know, I'm not that big in the music in that music scene.
Yeah, she's the one with the brown hair.
Oh, okay. Well, great. That's great information. So she is a Norwegian war child.
Yes, German and Norwegian.
Yes. Yes. Interesting.
All right.
Well, thank you, Hadding. Is that all you have to say? You've been
for the moment, anyway.
All right.
Thank you. I enjoy the show. Bye.
Thanks. Well, that was a good call. It's nice to hear from somebody who's sympathetic to this information and knows a lot about it. So I will continue now with Gerd Honzik. He gave us some more about that. But I just wanted to finish up by saying that what he did is so nothing. And yet they just had to put him in court and give him all these prison sentences. So now after the 4 years that he spent in prison in the 60s, he had to spend another 3 years. And he's a very strong-looking man. He's now 68, it says. And they didn't make any fanfare. And, of course, they don't like to talk about these things in the German and Austrian press. You mostly read about it in the Jewish press and in the AP that, you know, goes out in English and so on, and they don't want their people, they don't make any kind of fanfare about these revisionist criminals that they consider to be criminals. And he was released from prison, and supposedly he's already returned to Spain. His family was still there in Spain. You know, they brought him back from Spain. His whole family had gone there. He was living there fine. And now he's going back because they say that he was harmless there, and he had, well integrated, they say. He was well integrated in Spain where he lives with his family. So now he's gone back there. And I certainly wish him well, and I hope they leave him alone. If he's on parole, of course, he's not able to do any writing, any speaking, anything like this. And that's what they want. Once they let them out of prison, they make sure that they have enough strings on them that they can't go back to any of the things that they did. They can't go back to any of the writing. So that's why those of us who are not in danger, and also those of us who are younger and haven't served in prison yet, wherever you are in the world, and I know there are a lot of brave men in Germany and Austria. I know some of them, and they're women too, and they are they are doing what they can. But this Gert Hanzik, I want to say something about him. I found something on the internet here, on radioislam.org. He wrote a book called Fiend and Felon. It's about Simon Wiesenthal. It's called Fiend and Felon, America's Idol-a Crook! Power, Perjury, and Murder in Simon Wiesenthal's Footsteps by Gert Hanzik. I would really like to read this. I have such a hard time finding time to read everything I want to read, but I would really like to read this. It's all there on the internet at http://radioislam.org. And then you go /historia/Hanzik/HanzikHTM. I'm sure if you Google it, you can find it. Fiend and Felon. I was just Googling Gert Hanzik, and I came across it. So that would be a very good thing to read. And that leads me to the last thing I think I'll talk about, and that is a new blog that I put up on the Elie Wiesel Cons the World website today. I think it's one of the most important things I have ever put up on this site, and I have written quite a lot for it already. I don't know how many. I went through them today because I was looking to see how many of the posts that I put up here I had talked about Elie Wiesel at Buchenwald and these misidentifications of these different boys, in marching boys and stuff, where they say that Elie Wiesel is there and in which he isn't. But mostly now, nobody says that Elie Wiesel was one of these, was in these pictures of marching boys, except Ken Walzer still hasn't repudiated that, but he's going to have to, because nobody backs him up. But here, what I've done today, and why I think it's so good and so important, it's titled "Gigantic Fraud Carried Out for Wiesel Nobel Prize," and it goes over this famous Buchenwald photograph that Elie Wiesel claimed that he was in, but was first claimed, I think, by the New York Times, and then he agreed or something. I'm not sure. I've never been able to find a statement by Elie Wiesel where he said, "That's me in that picture," or when that was first came out. It just sort of entered into the consciousness that this was Elie Wiesel in this picture of the bunks back in the way back there in the semi darkness. But I have someone who has been corresponding with me, whose name I don't give. I don't even know his name myself, really. But he has sent me some very good quality pictures of the best picture I've seen of a close-up of this inmate's face in this famous Buchenwald photograph, because generally it's dark. You see, it's dark in the photograph, but he somehow has lightened it. I don't know what he's done. It's kind of in sepia, and you can really see this face. And then he has this wonderful, very clear image of the 15-year-old weasel, which is a well-known photograph of weasel in 1944, before the deportation, you know, before any of this happened. I don't believe that Elie Wiesel was deported to Auschwitz. That's my working hypothesis, and I'm getting closer to it all the time, to making a airtight case for it. But at this point, I just say that this is before he supposedly was deported to Auschwitz. And it's everybody knows it's him. It's 15 years old. But I have here a picture that's very clear and just close up of his face. And so we have these two faces here, 15-year-old Elie Wiesel and this inmate in the Buchenwald famous photograph that the New York Times declared in 1983 for the first time that this was Elie Wiesel in this picture. And supposedly Elie Wiesel started saying that that was him at that time. And everybody started saying it. And the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, which really was not in existence exactly in 1986, I don't think, has gone along with that too. And so the whole world says that that's Elie Wiesel. But if you actually get a good comparison, just that alone shows, you can see that it's not him. It's not him. And then we have some other pictures, which the one is on the U.S. Holocaust Museum website, but I got this fellow, whose name I don't know, sent me a close-up, which helps too, of there's a photograph there of Elie Wiesel at a prayer service in 1945. And this is definitely Elie Wiesel in France. So I'm not saying that Elie Wiesel wasn't in France and that he wasn't in this orphan's home, but I don't think he came there from Buchenwald. He came there some other way. And here he has a huge amount of hair on his head, very long hair. He has this huge, very long hair in front, so it's hanging down along the side of his face. So his hair has grown, is very long, not in the back, but in the front, so that, you know, you'd comb it back and it would be, you know, there's a lot of hair there, long. And this has to be in October, between June and October 1945. Couldn't be later than October 1945 because it's known and it's been said over and over again that all the kids and the staff at Amblois, which was where this picture was taken, were relocated to Taverny in October. So by October, they weren't at Amblois any longer. So this picture had to be taken before October 1945. Well, guess what? In April 1945, April 16th, when this photograph was taken of the inmate, these inmates at Buchenwald in this bunk number 56, here we have this shaved-headed person who is supposed to be Elie Wiesel. His head is totally shaved. You can see, you also see that he has a receding hairline, and he's definitely not 15, 16, or 17 years old. But his hair could not have grown so fast between April and October to have all this long hair in the front that Elie Wiesel has in this picture. So that is really what you'd have to say is photographic proof. Photographic proof is pretty good, isn't it? What's better than that? That this inmate in the Buchenwald picture could not be Elie Wiesel, on top of the fact that it doesn't look like Elie Wiesel. So we need to put this around. I've gone through it all, and I've gone through why they did this, why they claimed that this was Elie Wiesel, because he was campaigning to get the Nobel Prize. And they were campaigning to get him either the Prize for Peace or Literature. And they really didn't think he'd get the Peace Prize, but they thought that he could get the Literature Prize. Well, the Nobel Committee ended up giving him the Peace Prize. But this was when this all came about, that they started claiming that this was Elie Wiesel in 1983. And in 1986, after 2.5 years or so of, or maybe it ends up being 3 years, but of campaigning for Elie to get the prize, he finally got it. And it was a great and glorious day in his life, and he has never let anybody forget. From that time on, whenever you read about Elie Wiesel, it says Nobel laureate. But we have to make it known everywhere, friends, that this person in this picture, that this is a fraud, and they've been perpetrating this fraud purposely, knowingly, deceitfully. And lots of important people are involved in doing it since 1983. And yet it's clear that it's not him, and he would know it's not him. Who would know better than Elie Wiesel himself that was not him? But he's been saying it's him. And so I have a lot of others. This is important evidence, important information, if I do say so myself. I've been working on along these lines, and I have a lot of previous blogs, which are a lot of which give background information on all of this development. But it finally all came together in this particular blog post. And I think it's quite excellent myself. And what I've heard from other people up till since I posted it just around noon today. Let's see. It says 10 a.m. That's 12:08 my time when I posted it. The few people I've got messages from, they say, well, that's just excellent. They're excited about it. But what we need to do is not just leave it here on Elie Wiesel Cleanse the World and the few people that I can get to come here and look at this and read things. People need to put this out, and this needs to be a big effort, because this is big. This is big, and it needs to be a big effort to get this information out there and force recognition of it, that this basis of Elie Wiesel being at a Buchenwald is false, and not only false, it's fraudulent. It's a purposeful fraud. It's what you'd call a hoax, but I'd rather call it a fraud, because they're committing a fraud with this. And it's gigantic. It's gigantic for the Holocaust survivor industry, and it's gigantic for Elie Wiesel, and it needs to be pushed into the consciousness, and even pushed into media, and pushed into alternative media. All this phony alternative media that won't even want to talk about this, probably, because they don't want to uncover anything. I'll get back to the alternative media here, that does not want to uncover the truth, because then they might be out of a job. I guess they won't be able to sell any more cancer busters. That's one of the things that Charlie Giuliani and his friend Mike Anthony sell, cancer buster pills, you know, sure. Or all these seeds or dried foods and so on, for the emergencies that are coming along, or even face masks. Yeah, when I used to listen to to these programs, and it was on RBN quite a few years ago, when they were and I was kind of new to it, and they were talking about swine flu, and I believed it, and I even bought a whole package of face masks, because they said, you know, when this hits, you won't be able to buy any, and you'll need to be wearing them. And I still have them up in my closet to remind me, you know, I don't think I'll ever need them. Now, they didn't cost all that much, 30-some dollars, and I thought, well, that's a cheap enough investment for what might be really serious. But, you know, they keep finding new people to buy this stuff. So this alternative media, they won't even want to talk about this. I don't know. We'll find out, won't we? I need people to help me in pushing this around. Now, the other thing about it that Well, I guess I did talk. I guess I did say everything because it's about the Nobel Prize. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming to the end of this program. I want to thank you very much for listening. I want you to know that I will be, I'm trying to get my little clock up here. Yeah, I want you to know that I will be continuing with this 2 hours, and I'm thinking about changing the title of the show so that it's not called the Heretics Hour anymore, because I don't want to go back to 1 hour. In any event, come back next week and for another 2 hours.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.